Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the AES lecture. I'm Ben Sutter, the chairman, and I'll be introducing Gavin in a moment. 2 points of admin: if macOS X catches fire, the fire exited behind you where you came in. The second point of admin is there's quite a lot of new people here. I'll be passing this down. This is just a sign-up sheet. Whether you're an AES member or not, put your name down, and it's good to know you're here. Thank you. Gavin is, as you probably know because you're here, from Future Audio Workshop, which is a synthesizer company based in Donegal and also based in Berlin. And he'll be showing us bits of the underneath of the very successful Circle Software synth. Now, I work for Novation and I make hardware synths, so I'm very, very interested in what you have to say. No pressure at all.
Yeah.
You're not here to hear me, you're here to hear Gavin, so I'll pass over. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for the introduction. Yeah, so I'm here to really talk about what exactly is going on behind the interface in Circle. So maybe it's first best if I give a demonstration of what Circle does and what its capabilities are, and then we can lead into the technical aspects of the design of it in software. So Circle is a modular synthesizer. It has four oscillators down here on the side. They're changeable between analog and wavetable. You know, your classical wavetable oscillators. You then have a mixer section here. You have insert effects, parametric EQs, all the usual types of distortions, bit crushers. Then you have like an analog modeled filter in the center here. And then you have another insert effect and your VCA. Along the right-hand side here, then you have modulation sources, which can be connected up to any control on the interface. So the way we were kind of thinking about when we were designing the synthesizer was to kind of think about modulation as like an extra pair of hands. So, you know, you can just kind of take a modulation source and put it onto the filter there. And if I open up the keyboard, so you can see how the, and you can maybe slow down the rate there. So we want to kind of make everything more visual as well, so you can kind of like see the modulation. You know, for your classical hardware synth, everything's very abstract. You're just looking at a control panel and you don't actually see where the modulation signals are, or you don't, you know, see where the connections are. So we want to kind of bring out all that information and use software for that. Yeah, then we have our settings pane. Then we've effects section on the output. Three effects here. So you've like echoes and various phasers. Hurts everybody's ears. Yeah, not the first time. All right. So yeah, that's kind of the basic system that Circle is. Behind that then is a whole modular audio library written in C++. So what I'm going to talk about next is what exactly happens when, let's say, I take one of these modulation sources and drop it here, and then adjust the amount of that modulation. What is happening in terms of the flow of audio, you know, how that's arranged, how the whole thing is put together. So I'm going to start with a PowerPoint presentation. They're always very exciting, so you can, well, it's more to keep me on track so I don't get too lost. Yeah, it's a modular synthesizer, VST audio unit, RTAS. It's out on Windows and OS X. My background myself is I studied DSP in Queen Mary. I then went to work in a company called Arturi in France. They're a plug-in company. They also do hardware synthesizers. Set up the company in 2007. Circle itself, it took 1 year development with four people working on it. So there was two developers, myself and a guy called Pierre, and there's another two graphic designers. So in total, it was 1 year development time. Where to start? Like, how do you go about building a plugin? There's so much stuff there that has to be dealt with. Like, how do you make sure that when you build this plugin that it's going to work in RTAS, it's going to work in VST, it's going to work on the Mac, it's going to work on Windows? We decided that we would use an open source framework called Juice to allow us to do that. So basically what that means is that we can write one single code base and then target the different platforms without having to, you know, worry about what different platform we're on. It's all totally wraps up and encapsulates what we do, so it kind of abstracts out the hardware and the operating system from us. So if we want to open a file or load something into the software, we just use the one kind of function call in C++. We don't have to deal with different ones for different operating systems. And it just allows us to, you know, build something like Circle. Beforehand, let's say around 2000, there wasn't a framework like Juice, so you would need a massive development team, maybe, you know, 10 to 15 people to get a really good plugin done. You'd have to develop that kind of framework yourself and everything. So there's really a lot of credit has to be given to Jules, who wrote this Juice framework to allow us to do what we did. So where to start? We kind of had this idea of that we wanted to build a synthesizer. It's almost like back of a napkin stuff. You just sit down, drew out an interface, and kind of figured out what kind of modules we wanted to put into this, into the audio library. Just did a basic functional specification document, workflows, you know, special components. If you remember looking at the interface there, you saw the way the modulation was changing. We had to think about how all that would work and how that would kind of like work with the audio library and how we'd be able to display that information and interact with the DSP side of it. Yeah, so it's just draw the whole modular system on a sheet of paper. That's basically what we did. We started with something very small. So we would look at, let's say, an oscillator, a filter, and a VCA. And we would then write the code around that that would mean that we could maybe connect those three modules up together. And as we were kind of writing this, we decided that... I better get back on. Yeah, so we split this work into two first, the interface and the audio engine. So we use the model view controller pattern, which means that the interface has no real intelligence or logic inside it. It can be removed from the audio library, and the interface is kind of more disposable than, let's say, the DSP code, which will be the most important part and the most kind of like time-consuming part. So that's kind of that model view controller platform pattern. That's what Juice is based on. Just started establishing naming conventions between myself and Pierre. He was going to do the interface. I was working on the audio library. And where the two meet, there has to be solid naming conventions. Yeah. So we started off small, sine oscillator, filter, and an output. And we just wrote those little modules in C++. And then we started to kind of grow out from that. And as we started to build the different modules, we saw patterns emerging amongst these different modules. Like every module will have inputs, every module will have outputs, every module might have controls, you know? So you start to see how this system then can be kind of abstracted into something bigger and how you can kind of see the repetition between the modules. And then you kind of come up with an idea of how to kind of, make everything generic so that it can expand. Because it's easy to do something that's very small, like a sine oscillator and a filter and an output. But then if you go and expand that into, like, you know, 50 modules, it can get pretty messy very fast. So you have to kind of like start small, see what's common amongst everything, and then abstract that into base classes. I'm not sure how many people here are programmers, but you'll probably be aware of what I'm talking about if you are. So you start seeing notes as actions as well. Like if you have these modules, you say, oh, I want to connect this module to that module. So that means that's a function call, so that needs to be done. So we just came up with this module base class, which is like this common thing that every module is inside the audio library. I can actually show you what that class looks like if you want to see it. So. So this is the base class of all modules. Every module in our library, filters, oscillators, everything is based on this. If you're familiar with C++, you can see here, so the set input bus channel, this get module, that's the set module, process input connection. These are all functions that are common across every single module within the library. So we then put those into this base class, and that allows us to like then make things generic, so less kind of like complexity goes into the lower modules like the filters and everything like that, and then we can just have those up in a base class and not deal with them when you're actually writing your DSP code or everything. So you don't have to, you know, it's all about kind of making sure that things don't get too complex when the library starts to go from these like simple modules out into bigger ones. We've like oversampling factors, all this kind of stuff. So I'll just go back here. Right. Yeah, so we also needed some way of, once we have these modules with all their inputs and their outputs, we needed a way of actually like maintaining those connections. So when you saw earlier where I kind of got one of these outputs from a modulation source and connected it up to an input, we had to have kind of like a system that would kind of control all those connections and maintain them. And then if we like open up a new preset or a new sound, then it has to be able to build up all those connections between all those different modules. So what we did, we came up with this idea of an output pin. So each module has an output pin, which is basically just a pointer in C++. And around that pointer, then we create another object that describes what that pointer does. So is it like an audio source? Is it a modulation source? Is it, are we going to process it once every 32 samples? Are we going to process it at audio rates? Like if we need to do frequency modulation, you want to have like audio rate connections. So yeah, that's basically what it is. And you just kind of like get a module, you request its output pin based on a connection you're making on the interface with that dot. It goes into the list of modules, it takes that pin, and then it reads the descriptor, sees what type of pin it is, and then it drops it wherever you're going to drop it. And it just basically takes a pointer in code and just connects it up somewhere else. And that's how the audio connections are made. The modules are then stored inside a module store. So we've like a big array of modules here like this with identifiers. So you can kind of pull out modules whenever you want, depending on what connections you're making. It makes sense that modulations are processed first. So all those little sine wave generators and envelops and stuff like that, they're all processed first. Then we go and we do the audio line, which is in order of, as you saw it on the interface. So all those oscillators, they first produce all their sounds, then they're written into those pointers that are connected up to other parts of the audio library. They're then processed again, let's say in the filter and the mixer and everything, and then it's out to the VCA and into the host or out into your sound card. Yeah, every module has this process module function. So complexity, yeah. Basic system was created first, then we needed to scale up to 40 plus modules. And what we found is that as you start to scale up, that it gets super complex in terms of just maintaining the code. You know, if you have 40 modules and there's all this repetition across all these different modules, they all have process functions and they all have these different, you know, parameters that need to be set. So what we decided to do is that we would do auto generation. So rather than repeating ourselves 40 times, we just write one file that describes every module in the synthesizer, and we write that in XML, and then we use a script that reads in that XML, and then it auto-generates all the files for us. So we don't actually have to maintain like enormous amounts of files. If there's 40 files with all their different, you know, descriptor files for each pin and the inputs and the outputs. So yeah, we just use this auto-generation, and that kind of allows us to kind of keep things manageable, you know. So it's basically just an XML file, and we can add new modules. We just type in the name of a module, what its inputs and its outputs are, and then it gets added into the audio library. Yeah, which is what I'm describing there. Yeah, so you just insert the DSP code. So DSP. I studied in Queen Mary, and I became aware of the DAFX conferences. So a lot of the DSP will be based on papers produced at the conference. And let's say for the filter especially, you know, we're basing it on the Pro 1 from Sequential Circuits. So what we would go about doing is creating, let's say, a 4-pole low-pass filter. We would then look at the hardware synth, and we would see that as you sweep the resonance on the filter, that it maybe gets like more stronger as you go up in frequency, and we would measure that kind of curve of how that resonance changes as you sweep. And then we would kind of maybe use lookup tables or maybe use some fitting curves to kind of match that filter curve. So it kind of gives us the sound of what we wanted to do. So you can kind of recreate the kind of that classic analog sound in the filters. Tricks of the trade, yes. The main thing is just to sit down and just draw the system out first. Start with small basic modules and units. Abstract everything that's common across those up into base classes, so you don't have to deal with them when you're writing your DSP code. Then look at everything that's common across all these different modules and write this auto-generation thing. So you can just basically type into an XML file what a module is, what its inputs and its outputs are, and then it generates all the associated files for its pins and everything like that. So it just makes it a lot easier, and you can scale it in a manageable way. Because if you look at commercial level plugins with that type of functionality, with a small team, you have to be able to kind of manage it in a way that it doesn't get out of hand, and the way to do that is through auto generation. The last thing was copy protection. I'd say don't waste your time is the main thing there. Circle was cracked within 3 days of release. So we launched it, uploaded it. Within 3 days, you could Google and find it somewhere cracked. So it's just don't waste your time. The most important thing is that people cannot create like a key gen. These key generators are just like things that produce serial codes automatically. If they can do that, if they can create a key gen, that means they can just create a license code for every one of your softwares, regardless of your update. So you need to make it impossible for a key gen. So when we released it then at the Music Mesa, we went and showed it to distributors. We had a stand. They were all kind of impressed with it. We got the sound design done, so we kind of pushed it out kind of in its beta phase to sound designers. They kind of went and made preset sounds for it. After that, then we had to get our support stuff together, web store, all these other surrounding things, which actually proved to be a lot of work in the end. So at the end, it took about 1.5 years with everything surrounding like copy protection and all that kind of stuff. And then David Guetta used it in one of his hit songs, which was quite interesting. I was coming over today even, and I heard it on the bus. So it's like you're sitting down, you're listening on a bus, and you just hear this distinctive sound from something you've created in a hit song. So that's kind of interesting. Sound and sound were positive, which was kind of like the test of everything, really. And we got great feedback from the user base once they started using it and using it in their music. And yeah, so that's kind of the overview. So if anybody has questions, feel free to ask. I don't know. I don't know what people's backgrounds are, if they're programmers or. Does anybody has questions? All right, makes sense. Yeah. So has anybody got questions about the process and? Yeah.
I was just interested in whether it's easier for you to model a physical circuit or actually start from scratch on your own.
I think at the time that we were doing it, people are talking about doing like piece-by-piece models and that kind of stuff and working out exactly how the circuit works and then modeling every single component inside a filter. I think at the point we were doing it, the processor would be chewed by that. So I think what we were doing was we'd take like a broader look at the functional aspects of the filter and then maybe tune it empirically to match something that we wanted. So if we wanted let's say if we saw that like maybe it needs more of a DC offset, then we just add a DC offset. We'd have a look at the harmonics on a spectrum analyzer. We kind of see if those harmonics are matching up what we're doing in the software. If they're not, then we maybe try and use different types of non-linearities and everything like that to try and get out that kind of sound. It's the hardest part in analog modeling is you can really nail the sound at one point. It's when you sweep or change. That's when it gets really, really difficult. But there are ways of getting that right as well, or close enough, yeah, so that it doesn't make any difference. Yeah. Have you done physical modeling and analog modeling?
No, I've done that all, actually.
Yeah.
The electronic circuits side of it is my field.
Yeah.
I find it interesting where programmers start, where their starting point would be, and it's interesting that you say actually at one specific time, at one setting, at one frequency, rather than the whole audio band. It was just interesting to see whether you would say, okay, I have to take this oscillator from this synth schematic and try and recreate it that way, or just say, actually, I just know what the outcome I want and
yeah, it's more the outcome I want, and then every DSP engineer has their own tricks that they pick up along the way, and just kind of use those and use those kind of different ways of like tuning to match up to different synthesizer sounds that you want. But one of the things we're trying to do is maybe not get too focused on the analog side of things, and maybe when it's on a computer, it should be kind of like its own character and not make it an emulation of something. So that's kind of, you know, you want some of the aspects of the analog sound because it's like, you know, there is this tradition there, but we were also trying to bring in this digital side as well with, you know, the wavetables and stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Just a quick one. What was the hardest point for you? What was the kind of the trick where you almost hit the wall where you're like, do I still want to do this? What was the almost the death of Circle, shall we say?
There was no real point where we got that bad. Of course, over like basically what we did is that we the guy I started the company with, Pierre, we just moved to the countryside in Ireland and we just shut down, you know, and we just stayed there for like 1 year working, you know, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, just going to the shop to buy food. That was it. So you can imagine that if we did it much longer that we would have cracked. It did get a bit towards the end, but yeah. But I don't think there's any one specific point. I think once you just keep your goal ahead and you kind of break everything down into like smaller parts, and you kind of like try and make it manageable from the start, you're always aware of it getting too complex, then I think you can get to the end without too much trouble. And then as things work, you get more confidence about what you're doing, and you're always making sounds, and that sounds good, and kind of drives it forward. It's kind of an iterative process. It's, yeah, yeah.
Can you elaborate a bit on the bass class? Like how that works, how you designed that, I don't know.
We basically, what we did was, we just kind of figured out what a module would be, you know, like we have an oscillator here, what are its outputs, what are its inputs, all these different things. And then we just took that oscillator, then we created another module, so then it made a sound. And then we looked at that and we said, okay, all of these have functions called process the module. All of these functions, all of these modules have an on-off switch. All of these modules have inputs and outputs. And then what we do is we just take that functionality and we remove it from the actual module, the distinct module itself, and push it up into a base class. So we don't have to see it anymore. You know, we don't have to deal with it. And I think that's basically what the whole thing about this base module base is, that commonalities amongst the modules are then pushed up into the base class. And then when I'm working, I don't actually see any of that. I'm just working on a basic DSP code here, and you know, maybe some classes from the base class will be used in front of me, but I won't have to deal so much with that stuff, because you kind of have to be able to black box things and just walk away from them for a while in code, you know. So you don't, you know. So it's like, yeah. Are you a programmer yourself?
Well, just starting, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty standard, it's totally standard C++ thing, but it's just how to kind of identify what to put up there and, yeah, into the, and just to make it easier for yourself. And yeah. Any more questions?
Yeah, I just have a couple, actually, if I might. The first is what percentage of the sound do you think is defined by these analog modeling techniques versus the other side, which is just how you've designed the synth?
Yeah, when you try and emulate an entire synthesizer, that's like, you know, if you want to emulate a Moog or something like that, that's one process. With us, we just kind of had a look at the filter and kind of tuned it to a Pro One that we had. So then there was no real kind of like distinct synthesizer we were trying to copy. So whatever came out of the code came out of the code. If it sounded a little bit too aggressive, then, or there was kind of like maybe the distortion was too much on it, we kind of toned that down. We're kind of going for a more digital sound than you know, a lot of the other plugins. We're kind of thinking like, does the world need another analog emulation of a synth from the 70s, or are we better off just putting our own personality into it and kind of making something that's more digital sounding and whatever.
Do you feel that gave it like its kind of little special sparkle at the end, or is it really just kind of one of those things you do because everybody's analog modeling?
It's almost accidental. Sometimes, yeah. You know, if you're just you know, doing algorithms and stuff like that, and something just sounds the way it does straight away, whatever way you've done it, then after a while you kind of get into that sound, then that becomes the sound of the synthesizer. You know, I'd say like when Bob Moog was doing the Moog, he didn't know exactly what it was going to sound like until it was finished. So, yeah, and so it's a little bit of magic, and it's just process, really. You know, when you go through something, and yeah, sometimes it ends up a certain way, sometimes it doesn't. And, yeah.
The other question I have, if I may, is you talked about the how useful it was having frameworks like Juice in order to give you a started. I'm just wondering if you, along the way, designed any of your own scaffolding, if you will, to, for instance, like to do the analog modeling, like the code to design the kind of to come up with sort of you know, the wave patterns you then use to augment the filters. Did you design any of that along the way, and would you consider open sourcing that as well?
We did some little bits and pieces, but at that time open source was not, it wasn't what it is now, but we haven't open sourced any of our software. No. Yeah.
So I was actually going to ask about looking forwards and you know, what sort of comes next. And I just thinking about that, I thought, so who did you design this for? Did you kind of design it for yourself, or did you have a particular user in mind? And maybe, you know, what keeps you ahead of the game, and what comes next? Is it just making this synth better or easier to use, or different products completely? I mean, I don't expect you to give your kind of business strategy away, but I'm just sort of interested in what's next.
Yeah, I think the process is something that more so than changing Circle. I'd say Circle, it's Audio Engine, because of the Juice framework, I've actually been able to get it to run on the iPad. So because it has abstracted everything to do with the hardware, you can just kind of like target the iPad, and Circle's interface pops up the same way as it does on the iPad. Of course, we'd have to adjust the interface, but that could be some direction that we'd like to go in. But personally, I think that things are heading more in the iPad direction and Android, and yeah, I think the laptop itself. I was just saying earlier on that, you know, 15-year-olds probably won't ever buy a laptop or own a laptop through the course of their life. So it's going to be all tablets and stuff like this. So we're going to try and provide them with the tools that they need to make music. And yeah, and even like if you look at music industry itself, the actual selling of music is kind of like not happening as it used to. So I think the whole production aspects of music, making it this kind of like produced record that has this sound, I think that's kind of going away. And what we're seeing is like kids just kind of making music and directly releasing it to SoundCloud. So that whole release cycle is reduced down to, you know, a couple of hours, and that's immediacy. Like we did an iPhone application for a guy called Deadmau5, who's this kind of music producer, and what he's doing at the moment is like he has his fans on Facebook and SoundCloud. He makes a track in the afternoon and then he pushes it to SoundCloud straight away. So that's the production cycle. It's not this 1 year thing that, you know, involves like mixing and, you know, mastering. It's just like this cycle. So I think, yeah, that's what we're going to do, is try and maybe put some of those technologies into applications so you can push stuff out once you've recorded it. You know, I think we're in the era of everyone's, as you say, everyone's famous for 15 minutes, everyone's famous to 15 people. I think that's the new way things are going with the music industry. And that's good, too, because you think about, like, yeah, you know, is diminishing returns on how famous you are and the appreciation that you people give to the music you produce. So I think, yeah, letting everybody create music and share it is a positive thing. Yeah. And hopefully we put that in our software. Yeah.
I've got a question from a developer, really.
Yeah.
If you're designing a software.
The mic.
Okay, I can project. Can people hear me?
For the benefit of the recording, I'm now speaking into the microphone. If you're designing a soft synth, more so with a hard synth, you're starting out with a completely blank canvas. So you're interconnections aren't defined, the sort of effects you're using, the way that you filters aren't defined, and it's just two of you in a place in Ireland for a year, working 14-hour days, to a fairly loose spec. Now, as a designer myself, I wonder, how do you know when to stop, and how do you know when you've got the thing right? How did you get through that cycle and know, right, we've got a product now, let's release it?
When you say a loose spec, we had a fairly tight specification at the start, you know.
It's never tight enough.
Yeah, there was kind of like mission creep, as they say. Yeah, to kind of more stuff was kind of being put in every now and again. But yeah, we kind of before we started, we did know that it was going to be a commercial plugin, that it would have to appeal to a market, and it would also have to appeal to distributors. So we were aware of how to, you know, fix our specifications so it would work within that system. So yeah, we didn't get too. But I do know I've friends who are making a synth for maybe 4 or 5 years, and yes, it's never going to get finished. You know, it's like
pretty much the hardest thing to freeze is a parameter list. When do you stop adding modulation sources? That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
If I do this, it sounds really cool. Will the customer like it? Will the customer even know about it?
Yeah,
and it's questions like that can really derail a project if you don't nail them down.
We were working with good designers as well, like, and you know, sometimes you can be in this kind of bubble. It's always a problem with when you're working on something and you know how it works, and everybody else who's working on the project knows how it works, but the customer hasn't a clue when they see it. You know, it's like, what is this? So we did have designers, if we were going too far off on a tangent, that they'd say, okay, guys, you know, that's like understandable. Please go backwards. Yeah. So it's always important to, yeah, I would recommend it, you know, getting your user base involved early in the development.
So you did do a lot of user experience testing?
Mostly on ourselves, like we're testing components and stuff like that. We'd send them over to the designers, they'd kind of test them out and say, oh, that feels a little bit not right or whatever, and then you kind of go back and try and change it so that it works properly. But it's very hard to kind of sit down and totally know what you're going to do at the start, but you can have a good framework within it so that you get to the end of the project and it doesn't get out of control. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah,
that's pretty much where we are too.
Yeah.
Get the users and the patch designers to make some of those decisions for you, and they're generally right.
Yeah, it is. And sometimes, like, the big problem as well with synth design is that, you know, you start to ask your customer base and they all have like small little quirky requests themselves, and then they all get pushed in, and then it becomes like a jack of all trades and a master of none. It's, you know, so sometimes it's good to be able to, you know, say no to features, you know.
You can domesticate your users to some extent, I think.
Yeah.
And you have to.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Have the microphone of power.
Thank you. I'm from Queen Mary as well. Well, hey.
All right, yeah.
I have a question about, so you said it was a year in development. Was it something that you funded yourself, or did you get investment prior to developing it to allow you to have that time? Because it sounds like a wonderful...
We were lucky enough that my parents had a spare house that we could stay in for 1 year.
Right.
That meant the rent was taken care of. We then had savings as well that could keep us going food-wise. It really was like that. You know?
Okay.
And we also got some help from the Irish state for a new business startup, so... But it wouldn't have been any substantial amount compared to what, you know, people normally would need if you're in a large city paying a higher rent and everything. So, but it's doable. It's totally doable if you can find somewhere with cheap rent. You know, a lot of people. That's why Berlin is kind of the center of music software, and it's kind of getting good with startups. Is that you can actually move there and live, you know, be able to actually survive in a city with people. Because that's the other problem is getting connections. You know, and finding right people to work with and. Yeah, it's important, to be able to be in a city and be able to keep your rent paid and food on the table and be able to develop stuff. We couldn't do it, so we had to move to the country, but I think you can... Berlin especially, I think, is that's why music software is popular there, because of that situation whereby rent is so cheap and food is cheap and there's all these people around there who are interested in music, and it just creates this kind of perfect storm for like Ableton and Native Instruments and all these things, yeah.
Also, what did you, I know this is about the kind of back end side of it, what did you do the UI in? What did you do, what did you code the UI in?
It's all done in Juice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So okay. They're just juice controls. You know, if you've seen juice, they're yeah. like, yeah. They're, and there's also custom controls in there. But there would be juice controls with overlaid bitmap images on top. So it's almost like a flick book when you turn. If you just see here, just give you a quick look. Yep. Yeah, so that's a standard juice control there, and that's a standard juice pop-up. And we've just overlaid those with images, so as you turn, we're like looking into an array of images and just displaying them. But then, of course, there's loads of custom controls. Like, this is not a juice control here, this sine wave. So what's happening there is that the interface is going into the audio library. It knows what module this is. It's looking at the output that audio module is producing and then displaying that in this curve here. And as we're turning this here, it's setting a value in module base for the rate of the LFO. Yeah. So, yeah. And what are you doing yourself? Are you a programmer? Or?
I'm doing my master's in kind of similar field, DSP
yeah.
kind of stuff. A little bit more hardware
yeah.
at the moment. But, I mean, everything reverts back to code and
yeah.
everything like that.
Can't
so.
Get away from it, yeah.
yeah.
Does Juice handle the graphics for that, or do you have to have a separate library for...
No, Juice is handling the graphics, yeah. It Juice handles threading, it handles everything, yeah. yeah. Messaging between the interface and the audio library. So, like, every time I turn a knob here, yeah. This kicks off a Juice... event, and that event then triggers a system that we have in place for communicating with the audio library in a way that it doesn't kind of like makes it thread safe and whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Does it also do the kind of, sorry, does it also do the,
does it also do the like vector operations for, is it optimized for vector processors like no. iOS?
Do you know? No, there's we're not using any kind of juice functionality for the DSP or
anything like that.
It's basically just for the interface and communication with the audio library, and also to allow us to do VST, RTAS, and audio unit plugins. Yeah.
Is there any trickery with the DSP that you, like in iOS, which I work in, there's it's called yeah. the Accelerate framework, which lets you do harness the RISC processors, like vector operations, instead of having to loop through your buffer and like, you know, add the waves, you just do one command and it's
does, yeah.
massively faster.
Yeah.
Is there anything like that that you've utilized for the Mac PC kind of platform?
No, I think a lot of the time, you know, your compiler gets you to a certain point, and for that extra maybe 5%, you could spend another year just kind of get that 5%.
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah,
yeah. Look at when you get into iOS, it's called the Accelerate framework. I mean, it wasn't it was like 50-60%
was it
reduction
yeah.
in CPU by doing these vector operations.
Yeah.
yeah.
Thanks. I just wanted to ask about the hardware platform. So if, for example, you were coding for a platform that had 100 times faster CPU or 100 times more memory, would you have done anything different?
Yeah, I think most, like the most DSP techniques, you can kind of like just scale them up more, you know. If you want to do interpolation, you just go to a higher order, you know, and all those things can help with the audio quality. So if you did have this computer that could do anything you want, then maybe we could get into doing these piece-by-piece models and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, but I think for us, it was enough because, you know, I think the sound, we were happy with it in the end and everything like that. I think you can always, you know, kind of optimize, but I think we're at a point now where it's not, I think most computers that people have are able to run the latest plugins and be able to get, you know, 16 voices on a fairly heavy patch. And I think that's all most people need, yeah.
So is it basically a case that users wouldn't notice if you were to build in this extra functionality?
Yeah,
or extra performance.
Yeah, they probably would notice, but it all depends on what type of music you're making. You know, if you're layering up 20 circles and trying to use, you know, 16 voices on each one, then yeah, you're going to run into trouble. But most people are just like using, you know, mono patches with, you know, bass lines and maybe some pads and stuff, and mixing it with other synths that they're also running, like, and yeah, I think.
Yeah. Just a kind of a business question, an earlier one down here. I'm in a null somewhere in the wireless network. So I was wondering how much market survey you did before setting out on this, setting up the company to assess the potential economic success of the company. You could say, you know, were you led by your head or were you led by your heart to go into the soft synth business?
It was totally by heart, yeah, I'd say. Yeah, you know, if you're leading by your head, you're not going to get involved in plug-in design, you know. There's like 100 other things you could do and probably be financially more successful at. But for me personally, I was, you know, interested in this. And I'm interested in building a career in audio. Yeah. And I think there's so many opportunities, you know, for just guys starting off now. And with these frameworks and with even with iOS and everything, that if you can find two or three people that you get on well with and you can, you know, maybe just kind of focus on something for a year, you can, you know, produce a piece of software that can, you know, sustain you all, you know, for a good number of years until you have to develop something again. And I think, yeah, that wasn't the case up until recently. It's all these frameworks and everything they're helping, and the, you know, the App Store, they're taking that whole distribution thing, and it's box software, which you'd have to get all that mechanisms around in your company. So it's becoming more and more easy for individuals who've kind of common ideas to get together and make software and actually survive and live on it. Yeah. So maybe, yeah, it's maybe the new music industry is more software based. Maybe, you know, instead of recording a song, you create a machine that makes music. It's, you know, there's other ways to make a living from music than, yeah. Now that the old ways are kind of falling down, but there's, you know, if you look at what's happening around you and just kind of, yeah, use that, you can still work with music. Yeah.
You said at the start you drew it all out on a napkin and expanded, a drawing.
Yeah.
Would you not try building it in Max or Reactor first? Or,
yeah,
you know, how would you go from that idea to this is kind of what it sounds like? Or did you have to sort of code a large portion?
You'd have to code before you figure out what it would sound like, yeah. But you kind of like, once you do your oscillators and your filter, you generally have a good idea of what it's going to sound like. So if you get those done early on in the process, you kind of have a general sound. Now, it will change at different points, you know, if you kind of like, once you then put five oscillators together, maybe they're kind of like the phase of them is kind of like canceling each other out, or it's making kind of like different types of sounds that you weren't expecting, and then maybe you have to kind of like put in stuff like offsetting the phase on different oscillators and all these things to kind of.
So you came up with the idea in your head, you put it on paper and you coded it and heard
it, and you start tuning and seeing, oh, that sounds good, that doesn't sound good. Yeah, so it's kind of like a process rather than taking something that was already established, like a Moog, and then saying, okay, we want ours to sound exactly like that, which is probably not that interesting, like if you're you know, if you want to do something that's your own rather than someone else's. Yeah,
okay, that was just my question.
Yeah,
that was it.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know, I mean, you said you didn't want to follow just a Moog and then try and emulate that, but
yeah,
you must have had some sonic references so that when you did code it and you did hear it for the first time, you thought, that's either bang on what I want or it's a million miles away. Was that all in your head, or did you have specific things you'd have in the room or in the office that you'd kind of play on and refer back to in the design stage?
Yeah, it was a lot of it too was based on kind of like style of music we were kind of listening to at that moment while we're coding, you know. I know Pierre's French and he's into this kind of like French house music and whatever, and he was like wanted to get it kind of more gritty and dirty, so he'd say, yeah, we need to put in a distortion in there, or we need to make it more rough, we don't want to kind of like a, just a nice synth, you know. So yeah, it's all those things, and as you're going along, then you can kind of change the sound depending on what you want to do. We did really want to go for a digital sound, just purely just to make it kind of unique and kind of what we're into, you know. Yeah, so that would have meant, you know, kind of maybe not having so much kind of like variance in the sound. So when you press a key, that it kind of just keeps maintains that same kind of sound in the oscillator, and yeah, removes out a lot of that kind of variance that was in the analog emulation type of stuff. Yeah, yeah.
And how about with your sensitivity now to other people's soft synths? Have you found that having dedicated so much time to making one and tuning one, that when you hear other people's, you kind of think, oh yeah, I know what that's an easy one. Or, you know, has it changed the way you look and listen to other people's software?
Yeah, it changes the way you listen to music. It totally, like, you know, but that comes with DSP and engineering in general. Like, you know, once you know what's going on, you kind of, you know, it changes the way, yeah, you hear a sound and you no longer actually kind of just hear the sound, you're like thinking about its frequency on a spectrum analyzer, you know, this kind of stuff. And yeah, so that yeah, and when you hear other people's synths, then you kind of like think maybe that's the type of algorithm they're doing, or, you know, you can kind of tell. And it's amazing that whatever it is, once you start to do something with even with software, you know, even in a defined way compared to analog circuits, that it can actually end up quite a variance from where you thought you would have started, you know, in terms of the sound and everything. Like, we did not know that that's the way that synth was going to sound until it was finished. Yeah, so that's this kind of interesting process as well. Yeah, yeah. No, I don't think anyone sits down and says, okay, I want it to sound well. You do if you're going to try and make a Moog, but if you're trying to just do your own thing, you just kind of say, okay, see what happens as we're going along, you know. I think that's, yeah. Yeah.
So you said you wanted to make a digital synth, but then what did you do about aliasing? You know, like if you have square waves and they get high, you get harmonics that get reflected back
exactly, yeah,
through the sample rate.
Yeah, well, there's all ways of doing that. You can just like oversample your audio engine, so you just run it at 4 times or whatever, 8 times the rate of.
All right, so that's what you did.
I then step it down again when you want to get there, so your aliasing doesn't come in.
Right. Okay. So you deliberately tried to counter that.
Oh, you have to. Yeah. You know, sound on sound will, you know, go through all this with a microscope and.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're aliasing. Gordon Reid will write it in his review, so yeah, you have to make sure that you get it right. Yeah.
So, from what you said earlier about the relevant for iOS, presumably you're not that interested into whether it'll work under AAX plugin format.
Yeah, I think the AAX, that's whereby you can run it on the Pro Tools hardware. It is possible for us to do it because, again, thanks to Juice, they now allow us to just take our code base and just target AX, so it'll.
Oh, right. So Juice, yeah, will do that.
It will, yeah, yeah.
Right. And did you make your own copy protection system?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, yeah. As I said, it was just enough so people couldn't create a keygen. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But we set up like a server, a copy protection server. So when you first go to use the synth, it dials to the server and checks the code, and then it uses some kind of encryption there and sends it back again.
And are there libraries for doing that, or did you have to basically make your own?
We had to kind of do our own, but there's kind of ways of you kind of figure out how to do it. You know, it's kind of like I don't want to get too much into give away the secrets, but yeah, it's yeah, and you just put checkpoints in the code. That's how they crack this off. It's just checkpoints in the code where we check this code. That's key file stored in the hard disk. And the guys who are cracking the software, they just decompile it and they can see what's happening here like this. They see it's checking the file and they just basically delete out that line of code, and then there's your copy protection gone. So, and there's no way, you can do all kinds of tricks, but they're always going to find it. Like, it's.
So that, is it tied to a particular machine?
It is, yes, yeah. So it takes the MAC address from your network card and then uses that to kind of create a hash code that's sent back to the server, and then that gives you back a license key. And, yeah.
And so you issue other multiple authorizations to some people if they're running on more than one computer.
Move them around. But I think, I know that the industry kind of went into the whole key thing for a while, but I think that was more kind of punishing people who are paying for the software rather than,
Well, it's better than Apple's system where you just need a serial number and you can install it on as many computers as you like, really.
Yeah.
For logic and things like that.
Exactly. I think where a company really needs to just accept that, you know, you're going to get cracked and that most people are going to use cracked versions. Professionals, you hope, would then pay for it. And the best you can do is offer really good support. So if someone, a professional, has a problem, that you can reply back in, 12 hours to that problem and solve it for them. And then it's almost like that contact is what they're paying for. That's rather than the software, because it's cracked and it can be found everywhere. So that's what we see, is that you have to really support is what people are buying more than the software now. That seems to be the way people are thinking about things. Yeah.
And do you feel it's repaid your investment in time?
Oh, yeah, big time, yeah.
Big time.
Yeah, well, it's just, it's a great process to say, because it's always a bit like jumping off a cliff and saying, I'm quitting my job and I'm going to just kind of make a company with a friend, And it's like that whole process. And then you get to the end and then you, go to Mesa. And then, I remember when I was 14 or 15 reading Sound on Sound and getting it in the local newsagent and not understanding anything about anything in it, but wanting to know about it. And then seeing something that you've built being reviewed in that magazine and kind of getting that positive feedback, it makes it all worthwhile, yeah.
But then presumably you can reinvest.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you have to kind of, then the next thing that comes, you have to try and start thinking about how to build a company so we can sustain ourselves and, for your friends that want to work in the same thing, that we can create a company that is sustainable so that we can all kind of build lives and stuff like that. So.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, build out from there. All right.
I'm intrigued from a totally non-programmer side of it, more a user side.
Yeah.
So you've got this lump of code that is your... we've got this lump of code that is your synth, and you've got this front end on it that you've basically made look like an analog synth. Have you now thought to yourself, well, look, I've got this lump of stuff. Let's make an interface that's utterly different. Let's find a completely different way of attacking those parameters. I mean, okay, you've got your representations of waveforms that I wouldn't have on my VCS3, but it's still basically a VCS3. You've still got modules plugged together.
I know what you mean,
And one thing I've always wanted to do is be able to say, I mean, okay, the analog synth, you've got your knobs, you've got your pots, because that's the way the analog circuit works.
Yeah.
But now it's in digital.
Yeah.
You can say, okay, throw that whole front end away. Let's invent a new way of mutilating it.
Exactly, and I think that's kind of where the iPad comes in, because with this you're always going to be using it within the context of a sequencer program, and if you start to go too abstract or people are used to using a professional tool in a certain way, and then if you go too way in another direction that they don't understand, then your plugin isn't used. It allows us to introduce kind of new concepts, because you don't have that host, you don't have Logic, you don't have Cubase, you just have this screen that's touch interface. So and you can see what people are doing there. They're doing some super interesting things, that this whole, you can have three-dimensional spaces of parameters, and even kids, they don't even know what they're doing. They're just messing around with stuff, and it's kind of bringing that. This is an analytical situation whereby you kind of think about something you're going to do and then you go and do it. Whereas I think with the iPad and what you're talking about, that there is kind of ways of where you don't need to know anything about modules or anything like that and just kind of interact with sound in different ways. And that's super interesting as well.
That's because you've got your engine. So now you can just whack an interface
on it. Yeah, yeah.
And, I've had perverse dreams of force feedback gloves and 3D spaces and all sorts of things for mixing for years. But hasn't happened yet.
I have, yeah.
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 I just
thought
you might.
Oh,
just saying that.
So sounds a bit like Imogen Heaps' The Glove Project, where she's got some gloves and she can just waste stuff around and makes cool sounds.
Yeah,
or the Microsoft Connect as well, you know. Yeah, the resolution is a bit low on it, but that's all interesting stuff as well. Yeah.
Are you have a question, Dad?
Well, two things left. First thing, principal thing, is to thank you, Gavin, for a very engaging talk. Good not only from a technical point of view, but from a business one. It's actually quite inspiring. I might go and lock myself away in Ireland for a year and see what I come up with. So thank you for that. And you don't have to applaud for this, but thank you to Red Bull Studios for letting us use their venue. And thank you to everyone for coming.